Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. It seems to be a commonly held belief here in the United States that American interest in the Middle East only began when oil was discovered there. However, our guest for this hour, historian Michael Oren, says that the U.S. has been profoundly involved in the region for a couple of hundred years now, from the time of the founders, perhaps even into earlier America. George Washington, for example, had a policy on the Middle East. Thomas Jefferson said that it was his main overseas concern, and indeed America fought its first foreign war in the Middle East. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking with Michael Oren about America and its involvement in the Middle East from 1776 to the present. It is the subject of a new book that he has authored. The title of his book is Power, Faith, and Fantasy. It's published by W.W. Norton. Michael Oren is a senior fellow at the Shalom Center. He holds degrees in Middle East history from Columbia and Princeton. He's been a visiting lecturer at both Harvard and Yale. His last book, 6 Days of War, June 1967, and the Making of the Modern Middle East, was a New York Times bestseller and also winner of the Los Angeles Times Book Award. He makes his home in Jerusalem, but he is now spending some time in the United States, traveling around talking about his new book. And in fact, today he is in Chicago, and we'll be giving a talk, making an appearance at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. We are not sure whether or not we believe that it's necessary to have tickets for this. So if there are people listening in Chicago area and would like to attend, we're not quite sure if there still are tickets available. However, I'm sure that you can contact them, and probably the easiest thing to do would be to go to their website. And I know that indeed they have one, the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Otherwise, of course, if you're interested in reading the book, you can head down to the bookstore and look for it. And people who are listening are welcome to call in and make comments, ask questions. The only thing we ask of callers is that they are brief. We ask that so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different folks as possible. But calls are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Mr. Oren, hello.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Great. Thank you. Well, thank you for having me on the show.
Well, I appreciate you giving some of your time. Just as a way, as a general way of starting, and this is maybe almost an end of interview question, perhaps, but I suppose it could also be a beginning one. We are certainly now consumed with what has been happening in the Middle East and our involvement in that within, you know, what's just happened within the last few years. What does it do for us, and do you think it helps us here in the United States to understand where we are now, to look back a couple of hundred years and in fact see that there is continuity stretching now all the way back to 1776, continuity in the way that we think about the Middle East and in the way the United States has defined its interest there?
I, the risk of sounding superficial, David, I would say it's obvious that to understand where we're going in the Middle East, it's very, very important to understand how we got here. And I believe that the roots of America's current engagement in the Middle East do go far back. They go back over two centuries to the time of the Founding Fathers and even before that. To understand that America has interacted in the Middle East in unique ways, ways that has distinguished the United States from European involvement in the Middle East, for example. To understand that America's legacy in the Middle East is highly nuanced, multidimensional. It includes great acts of beneficence and even altruism as well, along with militancy and greed. And America's involvement in Iraq, it has many parts to it. There is certainly a power element. There's a connection to oil, certainly, to the war on terror. But there's also a faith-guided policy, which is not unique to George Bush. You could find similar faith-guided approaches to the Middle East among John Quincy Adams and Thomas Jefferson, certainly among Teddy Roosevelt and Abraham Lincoln. And I was personally shocked to find all this, but it's very much there. And there's a large degree of American fantasy, the way fantasies of the Middle East, mythic images of the Middle East, have impacted America's involvement there. To understand how we got there today, we have to understand how America has been involved in this region for a great number of years. And on the basis of that historical, or within that historical context, we can begin to plot our future forward.
Yeah. Well, it seems that here's a key point. And in making that point, you have to say that what we're doing now is much in line with what we have been doing for a long time. I think your key points are is that on the one hand, that Americans have long been fascinated by the Middle East, have been drawn to it, or at least their idea of it, which might not have squared completely with reality. But at the same time that they have been fascinated to it, they have come to it with this strong desire to, as they saw it, to improve it, to educate people and to convert people in a, both a religious sense and an economic sense. So in all of that sense, you have to look at where we are now, and you can argue about where, you know, whether we've made mistakes or not, but you have to say that where there is a continuity between where we are now and where we have been. In a sense, this the project that the administration would argue that's engaged in now in Iraq is a project that America seems to have been engaged in or thought that it was probably now for a couple of centuries.
To put it even more bluntly still, if we want to avoid repeating the type of mistakes we have made in Iraq, which we are making today, I think it's very important that we read our history in the Middle East.
To go back just a little bit to talk about early America and to talk about security concerns, because you do, you look, you're, what you're trying to do is sort of look on these as, on these three levels, if you said, that part of what has shaped our policy has to do with American power and its projection. Part of it has to do with faith, and part of it has to do with this idea of the Middle East that we have had that may or may not square with reality. If you just look at the first level, look at American power, it's something that in the post-Cold War era, certainly it's very easy to see. But one wonders, well, when we're talking about America of 1776, how is it that the extension of American power in at that age it would extend into the Middle East? I mean, I'm sure some people would say, well, what interest could we possibly have at that point in our history about what was going on that far away from the United States?
Well, it's safe to say that American power was born in the Middle East. Back in 1776, about 20% of America's exports went through the Mediterranean into the Middle East. America was a seafaring nation back then, heavily dependent on its foreign trade, and that commerce was being preyed upon by Middle Eastern pirates, operating under the state sponsorship of what is today Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, and Libya, the so-called Barbary states. The United States had no means back in the 1770s, 1780s of responding to this really mortal threat to America's economy. America didn't have a navy. Many Americans didn't want a navy. Navies were expensive to build. They were threatening to fragile democratic institutions. And moreover, the United States didn't even have a central government that was capable of creating a navy, because the 13 states were confederated under the Articles of Confederation. They weren't federated. There was no central government capable of raising taxes to create a navy. So the Middle East threat from these Barbary states forced delegates to the Constitutional Convention in 1787 to determine whether these disparate states would unite as United States, a singular as opposed to a plural noun. At the time of that convention, there were 127 American hostages in the Middle East. America was facing its first hostage crisis. And the issue remained quite divisive. People like John Adams believe that the United States should pay off the pirates. That's what the Europeans have been doing for centuries, that it was cheaper to pay them off, but the American people didn't have the stomach to go to war in the Middle East. During his presidency, America was paying about one-fifth of all of its federal revenues in bribes to Middle Eastern pirates. And opposing him was Thomas Jefferson, who believed that the American temper, as he called it, wouldn't abide by bribery. And he understood that it would be expensive to fight in the Middle East, but he insisted that the United States do so for no reason than to just assure its own sense of self, its own self-pride, as it were. And the issue came down to 1794, when the United States Congress finally created a U.S. Navy, and the bill creating that Navy said that these six first warships were being constructed specifically to fight in the Middle East. They followed America's first foreign war, its longest overseas military engagement. The first American servicemen to fight and fall overseas fell in the Middle East. It wasn't until 1805 that those Marines marched to Tripoli, that from the Marine hymn, the shores of Tripoli. In 1815, Stephen Decatur led an American fleet into Tripoli Harbor and finally subdued the pirates. About 27 cities in America are named for Stephen Decatur. So America learned its first lessons in power in the Middle East. The Middle East forced the United States to unite. It forced it to create naval power and to project that power for the first time thousands of miles from America's shores.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is historian Michael Oren. He is the author of a recently published book that looks at the involvement of America in the Middle East from the present going all the way back to 1776. The title of his book is Power, Faith, and Fantasy. It's published by W.W. Norton. And questions are certainly welcome. We have someone here who has been waiting patiently, and we will get right to them. Others who would like to call in again, certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We'll start out here with someone in Champaign, and this is line number one. Hello.
Yes, hi. I'd like to preface my remarks by quoting Michael Oren in his response to Jimmy Carter's recent book. Quote, in his apparent attempt to make American Christians rethink their affection for Israel, Jimmy Carter is clearly departing from time-honored practice. This has not been the legacy of evangelicals alone, but of many religious denominations in the U.S., and not solely the conviction of Mr. Bush, but of generations of American leaders. In the controversial title of his book, Mr. Carter implicitly denounces Israel for its separatist policies, but by doing so, he isolates himself from centuries of American tradition, end quote. I have three comments to make in response to that. Mr. Oren goes back to 19th century Christian Zionism to find a basis in American support for Israel. What I don't really understand the relevance of whatever, you know, it's a complicated phenomenon in terms of both philo-Semitism or anti-Semitism or whatever, but the idea that 19th century Christians envisioned a Jewish homeland in Palestine really, it doesn't say anything about their feelings about Jews, negative or positive, just as the movement to establish a black homeland in Africa for American slaves was racist, partly racist at its roots also. Nevertheless, I don't understand how this is seen as some kind of doctrinal justification for Christian and American support for the kind of Jewish and Zionist state which was surely not envisioned by evangelicals in the 19th century, and surely not in terms especially of dispossessing Christian Palestinians from their land. Beyond that, the justification, whatever the interest in Christian Zionism in 19th century America, the establishment of Israel was not an act of idealism. It was an act of pure power politics, pure American, British power politics post-World War II, to deprive the Palestinians of their land and to establish a Jewish state in the Middle East, which ultimately represents American interests in the Middle East, having nothing to do with Christian doctrine, however one might construe that. And for that reason, many of the more sensible and enlightened Christians have been highly critical of Israel's expansionism, highly critical and rightly critical of racism, of apartheid, and of the kind of incipient genocide that we find going on now, especially in Gaza. And I guess the third general comment I would like to make is that these are all efforts, whether it's Robert Satloff or Jeffrey Goldberg or Michael Oren, what we are seeing here in the past week or so are efforts to frame what is an ongoing genocide by talking about anything else, anything other than the fact that every day and in every way, Israel simply denies the right of the Palestinian people to exist equally and respectfully on their land with the state of Israel. And I would like to stay on the line, and I'd like to respond to what General, you know, what IDF General Oren, or Major Oren, or whatever he is, has to say. And I think also that whenever an IDF person is selling a book, that that person should be identified as an IDF person.
Well, Mr. Oren, go ahead.
Well, let me begin by saying thanks for the promotion. I am a major, not a general, quite a way down the line of ranks. Statistics were issued today by the foreign press that in the last 4 weeks, 80 Palestinians have been killed by other Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Every day, the Gazans have fired rockets into Israel at Israeli civilian settlements. Israel has not responded militarily. Now, there's these 80 Palestinians. have been killed by other Palestinians. The suggestion that Israel has is committing a genocide against the Palestinians is deeply offensive. Deeply offensive, I think, to the victims of genocide in this century, whether they be Muslim victims of genocide in Darfur, whether they be Rwandans, certainly Armenians, and certainly the memory of 6 million Jews. It's deeply offensive, ultimately, to the Palestinians themselves. And on a radio program of this caliber, I would hope that we wouldn't hear hateful accusations like that, deeply hateful accusations. I think there has to be a limit to discourse, even of an academic nature. As for my own identity as an Israeli, as an identity as a person who has served in the Israeli special forces, the paratroopers, and in reserve capacities for 30 years, including liaison with the U.S. 6th Fleet during the Gulf War, hide that. It's on my website. I write often for the press. You were quoting, sir, from an article I wrote recently about Jimmy Carter in the Wall Street Journal. The title of that article was Jimmy Carter's Book, An Israeli View. There's no attempt to dissemble these things at all. I am singularly proud of my dual citizenship and of my service in the Israeli army. Now, to go back to your question, the degree that I can cull any sense of academic integrity from your question beyond the mere hatred. And let's go back to, it's not back to the 19th century, it's back to the 17th century. The Puritans who came and founded this country in their desire to overcome the oppression from the central Church of England, the Church of England, looked for a biblical model. They looked back to the New Testament. They didn't find it. They looked into the Old Testament. And there they found the example of a people who had suffered in exile, who were enslaved, and who had been promised by their God in their religion, in their own language, to be rescued from exile and to be restored to their holy land. And the Puritans appropriated this legacy, this narrative. They became the new Jews. They came to this country, which they fashioned the new promised land, escaping across the desert of the Atlantic Ocean. And they gave about 1,000 biblical Hebrew names to their towns and cities. They gave biblical Hebrew names to their sons and daughters. They made Hebrew a required language at their universities. James Madison was a Hebrew major at Princeton. They almost made Moses the symbol, the great seal of the United States of America. And they concluded that as good Christians and good Americans, that it was their divinely ordained duty to assist God to fulfill his biblical prophecy to the old Jews, with whom they felt a particular kinship, and to restore them to the old promised land, then known as Palestine, languishing under Ottoman occupation at the time, as part of the Ottoman Empire, and that they would try to liberate this land and give it back to the Jews. Now, this we use the word evangelical ahistorically today. They weren't called evangelicals back then. They were called Presbyterians and Methodists and Baptists. All of them embraced this notion of restoration, of restoring the Jews. You had John Adams. You wouldn't be called an evangelical Christian back in the 18th century, saying that it was his fondest desire that 100,000 Jewish soldiers, as well disciplined as the French army, would march back into Palestine and reclaim it as a Judean kingdom. Abraham Lincoln in 1863 says that the idea of the dream of restoring the Jews to their ancient biblical homeland was one that was dearly felt by a great many Americans, and expressed the hope that the United States, once it had restored its own unification, its own union, could work to fulfill that dream. Woodrow Wilson, this is well before World War II, Woodrow Wilson was approached in May 1917 by Arthur Balfour, the Foreign Secretary of Britain, a British restorationist, perhaps the last of the great British restorationists, who wanted the British government to issue a statement in favor of creating a Jewish national home in Palestine. The British government objected, and Balfour hoped that Wilson, being the grandson, the son, and the nephew of Presbyterian ministers, would put his signature onto the document and thus persuade the hesitant British document to issue the proclamation. Wilson, against the advice of his senior counselors, did sign on that document, and then the British government was persuaded to issue the Balfour Declaration in November 1917, which became of the British Mandate in Palestine, and later still in 1947, the basis of the UN partition resolution creating a Jewish and an Arab state in Palestine. Asked later why he did this, Wilson said, "Imagine that I, the son of the manse, the son of the church, would have this opportunity to help restore the Jewish people to its ancient homeland." And finally, in 1948, when Israel was about to be created on the basis of the UN resolution, but was also about to be attacked by Arab states, the entire
foreign policy establishment in the United States, the State Department, the Pentagon, the Defense Department, warned that if the United States recognized this newly created Jewish state, that the Arab world would go over to the Soviets in the Cold War. There would be a cutoff of Arab oil to the West. Western Europe would fall to communism. And perhaps worse, the United States Army would have to intervene in Palestine to save Palestinian Jews from genocide. And that was a true genocide that was about to occur. The man they turned to with these warnings was Harry Truman, a gentleman who had read his Bible really repeatedly, claimed to have known it by heart by age 14, a Baptist. Harry Truman listened to all of these terrible, terrible warnings, locked himself in the White House for 12 hours, and emerged on May 14th at 6 p.m., a little bit after, and made the United States the first nation on earth to recognize the newly declared state of Israel. So, when I talk about Jimmy Carter separating himself from a tradition of American Christian theological support for renewed Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel, I think I have a strong historical background for saying this. And these weren't evangelical Christians. They were Christians who came from all different stripes. So it's strongly, I would even go far as to say that the idea of restored Jewish sovereignty in the in Palestine, the land of Israel, is hardwired into the American experience. And has been for many presidents since then, such as Johnson, President Clinton, whose pastor, surrogate father, called him to his deathbed and made Clinton promise that he would never turn his back on Israel. Carter really stands out as an exception in this tradition very much. And my article, incidentally, in the Wall Street Journal was really based, didn't take issue with Carter's history. Many people have done that. 14 members of his own institute have resigned in protest over his book. I didn't do that, but I did want to point out the theological problem that Carter does have with Israel. His book does reveal a deep theological problem with Israel, which is, as I said, it's an exception to a very long-standing rule. Just a last point about displacing Palestinian Christians in the Holy Land. I can only say that Palestinian Christians in Israel live as full citizens. They are, on average, more affluent and better educated than Israeli Jews.
Can I have a response to that?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
I would ask that the response not engage in hate conversation.
Nothing I've said is hateful. Okay, look, it's nothing new that religion and various forms of idealism are used to justify genocide and violence. This country, America, was founded by Puritan genocide against the native people. Okay, it goes on and on against in terms of slavery, etc. There's nothing new in people cloaking hatred and racism and genocide in religion and idealism. Zionism isn't any different in that regard, and it is not a hateful comment to simply note that. Okay. Beyond that, there's simply for you to appropriate the Christian tradition, to apply that this is the best that Christianity has had to offer instead of the worst. Okay. And that Zionism is the worst that Jewish history has had to offer. You know, you're simply attempting to cloak that Zionism has betrayed Jewish values, that there is apartheid within Israel, within the state of Israel, as well as in the occupied territories. It's been very well documented by Susan Nathan, somebody who should be on this program, as well as people like Jonathan Cook and so forth, who have written extensively on what actually goes on within Israel in the treatment of its Arab citizens. It's the deprivation of rights of its Arab citizens. But the thing that really, really has to be understood is that this is all part, this whole argument, this whole framing in Christianity, this is a neocon argument. This is what got us into Iraq. This is what's promoting Iran. Mr. Oren, General Oren, Major Oren, whatever he is, wants to invade Iran, wants to bomb Iran. This is all part of the same problem. And whether people call themselves Jews, whether people call themselves Christians, they better wake up, because this is catastrophic stuff we're going on here. This is really dangerous, violent, catastrophic stuff. And the civility can only go up to a point. I'm not the one talking hate. It's Robert Satloff and Jeffrey Goldberg and Michael Oren who are talking hate, and they're using my public radio station to do that.
The guest refers, by the way, I just mentioned Mr. Oren, that the other two people that he mentions have, in fact, been recent guests here on this program.
Jeffrey Goldberg is a very fine writer for The New Yorker, is the author of a very well-received book recently about his attempts to, as a former Israeli soldier, to establish a reconciliation with the Palestinian nationalist leader. Bob Sotloff is the head of the Near East Institute of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, is a very, very fine scholar of Middle Eastern studies, and particularly has a close relationship with the Moroccan government. I don't know what there is to object about either of these wonderful scholars and writers. Let me only say that my work, my book, Power, Faith, and Fantasy, is a work of history. I don't view my role as a historian to sit in judgment on history. I'm not the hangman of history. My book is, I hope, devoid of prescriptions about the future of American foreign policy. There's no advocacy in it that I try. Of course, no one can write purely objective history, but I strive to achieve that at least. And to lay my political opinions aside, yes, I have political opinions, very strong ones indeed. Some of them were voiced in front of Congress in 2003, where I was privileged to testify at the early stages of the Iraq War, and I came out very strongly against Iraq, American intervention in Iraq, so much for the neoconservative argument. No one's ever accused me of being a neoconservative. For reasons that I still hold today, that Iraq, like many other Middle Eastern countries, has only been held together by a preponderance of brutal, savage power, and that the United States, as a society, as a culture, would be incapable of exerting that type of savagery to hold Iraq together. And I didn't think, and I think that in my rare excursion into prophecy, I think I was right on target on that. I don't think, just in conclusion, that sweeping generalizations, accusations, really truly groundless accusations of genocide do not help at all in the very complex debate and discourse over Arab-Israel relations or even indeed over America's involvement in the Middle East.
Well, perhaps I just might say here for a moment that having now hosted this program for more than 25 years, we have over that time, I think, made a sincere effort to have a discussion of this particular issue, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and have had people on this program that were strongly in support of Israel and its policy and strongly critical of Israel and its policy. And it seems like almost every time we hear from people who say, well, when are you going to do the other side? And it's very difficult for us because we end up being whipsawn back and forth between the two points of view, trying in some sense to satisfy them and also see if we can find some sort of middle ground that would help everybody else who doesn't already have an ideological position staked out try to figure out what's going on. We will continue to do that to the extent that we can. And we're always interested in what people think about the programming that we're doing. We're trying our best to serve the needs of those people who indeed do think this is their station and do support it. And so with that, we will go on. Maybe I'll just reintroduce the guest again. Mike Oren, he's senior fellow at the Shalom Center. He is the author of a newly published book, Power, Faith, and Fantasy, America and the Middle East from 1776 to the Present. It's published by W.W. Norton. I guess I should have known that we really couldn't get much away from the present. Let's go on. We'll talk with someone next in Matt Toon. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello. I don't know where to begin. Maybe but first by saying shame on you, David, for letting that caller ramble on and go on and on for half the program. I mean, he truly has a minority view here and just rambles. I don't know, he has too much time on his hand or something. This book here, talking about the history and talk about other things that we need to be discussing, kind of find out where we've been to find out where we're going. And that is clearly a minority view that he's rambled with. And I just want to say, good book, and I will hang up. Thank you.
All right. Well, then we'll just go right to line number three, Champaign County. Go ahead.
Hi. It's a good book, but he hasn't read it, apparently. I associate myself with the previous caller's remarks, and I do applaud your efforts to be, equal side. But I remember when the PLO was first authorized as a negotiating partner by the U.S. and how the U.S. can take the position to do that. There was a long stretch of time when you didn't have any official spokespeople on from from the PLO.
Well, so, we did try, by the way, and we were just never successful. We would, if we could have gotten somebody who would have been willing to do the show, we would have done it.
Well, we can look at a database or something at some point. I do applaud your work, though, and it is a difficult subject to try. But I don't know who wrote the copy at the very beginning of the introduction. The implication was that oil was not important in the role. That long before oil was discovered, the U.S. was deeply involved. But then in the explication of the story by the author, obviously economics and financial issues were extremely important in it. So it doesn't have to do the discovery of oil to be that economics were involved. There's another issue. There was a contention that... That the U.S. Was intrinsically motivated in this, and that was also sort of dismissed. But the work of the author is that, of course, the U.S. Involvement was fundamental in the activities throughout. He didn't point out that Herzl actually was 2 years behind the first. Zionist meeting. There was a meeting in Ohio. I forget the specifics of it, but it was a Christian Zionist organization calling for a state in Israel. So what I'm saying is that far from minimizing the U.S. role, the author is actually pointing out that it's intrinsic from the beginning.
Well, Mr. Oren.
Well, certainly, I think I mentioned earlier that America's involvement in Iraq is definitely tied to oil, and I devote a lot of space, certainly in the post-World War II period of the book, dealing with America's relationship with oil and how oil really magnified the power component of America's Middle East involvement exponentially. One of the more interesting revelations of the book is the degree to which faith was attached to that element of oil and power. The relationship between Ibn Saud, the founder of the modern Saudi state, and American missionaries who came to the Middle East starting in the 1890s from Wisconsin, from not far from here, from the Midwest, came and established hospitals there. They, of course, couldn't proselytize to the Wahhabis, but they did establish hospitals. Those hospitals treated tribesmen belonging to the Saud tribe. And in 1928, when Ibn Saud began to have a sense that there was something under his desert other than sand, that there might be oil under there, and the British and French engineers came to him and said, give us a contract to prospect for oil, Ibn Saud remembered the Americans and remembered them fondly and turned around and made a contract with American oil companies. So even there's a connection with faith then. As for Herzl was not more than a few years late. I would say he was a couple of hundred years late. Christians come up with this notion of restorationism well before the Zionists do, the American Jewish Zionists. They even begin to call themselves Zionists before American Jews did. You may have been referring to a petition submitted in 1891, that is 6 years before the first Jewish Zionist Congress in Switzerland, a petition submitted by William Blackstone, a Midwestern media real estate mogul, who was a very strong restorationist, and this petition submitted to Benjamin Harrison called on the United States government to spearhead an international effort, to actually convene an international conference with the Tsar of Russia and Queen Victoria, again, to detach Palestine from the Ottoman Empire and give it back to the Jews. And this petition was signed by 400 leading Americans, including John D. Rockefeller, J. Pierpont Morgan, and William McKinley are signed on this. American Jews, about 2.5 million, came to this country between 1882 and 1914, were very much interested in integrating in their new promised land, not thinking too much about their old promised land. One of the first American Jewish Zionists was Emma Lazarus, the one who penned the New Colossus poem that's inscribed on the pedestal of the Statue of Liberty. She formed the first American Jewish Zionist group in 1884. Very, very few people joined. At the outset of World War I, the American Zionist Jewish Federation had about 12,000 members out of 3 million American Jews, very, very small. And it's really not till after World War I, and even till after World War II, that a large share of the American Jewish community throws its support behind Zionism. Prior to that, the overwhelming majority of Christians in this country are Christians, not Jewish.
Well, the Crusades, going back to the 1100s too. So we have the European project of reestablishing control in the Levant, as it were, is is longstanding. Zionism as a it was metaphorical for a long time in Christian theory, I think. Though I think it I see it as being hijacked, just as the way there are a lot of Israelis who believe that their role as being a garter of U.S. interests, the guardian of U.S. interests in the Middle East, is perverting far from it Zion becoming a peaceable kingdom where everyone can live together, it's creating the chaos that we have now. Thanks very much.
All right. I don't know if you want to make any response to that. Otherwise, I have another caller we can go to.
Have another caller, please.
All right. We'll go to Champagne Line 1. Hello.
This is going to seem like we're beating up on your guests, but I just have one point, and that is that I recognize that the Jewish Holocaust was one of our time's greatest tragedies. And one moreover that's very close to our self-understanding of what is the human in our modern world, you know. But I also understand that the establishment of a modern Jewish state in the Arab world has vast consequences and was a catastrophe for that population. That said, it's also a tradition in our country to be critical, and I think we have to be allowed to be critical of the Jewish state and its policies. We're very aligned to them. And I think that that's also one of our traditions, to be able to be critical of that. And I think we should be able to be critical of that without being labeled as anti-Semitic. I don't know if you want to refer to me to defend that. I will, but
you don't have to. I thoroughly agree with you.
Okay, good.
No, you don't have to. I criticize the Jewish state myself.
Okay, so we don't see the Bible as a land title exactly, do we?
Pardon me?
We don't really see the Bible as a land title exactly.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just simply saying that part of America's support for this Jewish state has long roots in American history. I'm an historian. I'm not arguing a political argument in this book. I'm trying to expand how this occurred. And I'm asking the question how and why. And there's an interesting story in the book. I found it interesting anyway. Maybe you will. Another important work of American Christian Restorationism was this book published in 1844 called Valley of the Visions, and a big, thick, gray book. And it again called on the United States to lead the world in creating a Jewish state in Palestine. It went so far as to call on the U.S. Navy to provision the Jewish state through the port of Jaffa till it could stand on its own economic two legs. And this became this book, Valley of the Visions, became an antebellum bestseller. It sold about 1 million copies before the Civil War. And the author of that book was the head of the Bible and Hebrew Department of New York University, and his name was Professor George Bush. And 2 days in the genealogy department of the Library of Congress enabled me to ascertain that George Bush, author of Valley of the Visions from 1844, is a direct forebear of our current George Bush, president. So here you see a connection. Does that mean that the Bible is the sole reason why Americans have the support for Israel? And about 70% of the Americans do strongly support the state of Israel, and that's by non-Zionist or Jewish polls support the state of Israel. No, there's other connections there too, probably the fact that Israel is a democracy. There may be a latent, as you, I think, seem to intimate, there may be latent animosity toward Muslims and Arabs involved in that as well. A final point about criticism. I have no problem whatsoever with criticizing the state of Israel's policies any more than I have problem with criticizing the United States and its policies. Any open society should be open to criticism. I served in last summer's war as a reservist. When you go into the reserves in Israel, you put on your uniform and you leave your political views behind. But when I came home from leave for 1 week in the middle of the war, I wrote an article for the Wall Street Journal, another for the New Republic, strongly critical of Israel's handling of the war, really quite condemning it. So, and then I put on my uniform the week after, and I left those political opinions behind. My only problem with criticism of Israel is when it sort of reaches beyond, say, criticism of Israel's attitude to the Palestinians, its settlement policies, Jerusalem policy, whatever, and gets into the realm of accusations of some type of international invidious conspiracy to control the nations of the world, dominate the banks and the media, which smacks of the protocols of the Elders of Zion and does evoke the Holocaust, which you yourself mentioned.
I only have about 10 minutes left here, and I have some other callers. I hope the caller will forgive me for wanting to go on. And I do also want to introduce again the guest for anyone who might have tuned in. We're talking with Michael Oren. He's a senior fellow at the Shalom Center in Jerusalem, where he makes his home. He has degrees in Middle East history from Columbia Princeton, has been a visiting lecturer at Harvard and Yale. He is the author of a new book, Power, Faith, and Fantasy, America and the Middle East, 1776 to the Present, published by W.W. Norton. He's now spending some time in the United States, traveling around talking about the book. And and today he is in Chicago. We have a couple of other callers here. We'll try to get him in the time that remains. Kankakee is next. This is line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
It sounds as though the history which the guest tells might very well be congruent with the notion of British Israel, the idea that the English-speaking peoples are the lost tribes of Israel. What does the guest make of that theology, and what would he wish to see next for the Holy Land? Thank you.
Well, the notion of the lost tribes is one that occurs in Restorationist literature, though often is directed not so much at Jews as it is at Native Americans. There was a branch of Restorationist thought in this country that saw Native Americans as one of the lost tribes of Israel. Indeed. What I'd like to see for the future, I'd like to see peace. Am I sanguine of that happening? Not in the near future at all. The Middle East is in the throes of tremendous turbulence. Not all of it is related, of course, to the Arab-Israeli conflict, Sunnis against Shiites, Kurds against Sunnis. In Lebanon, many factions fighting one another. And Muslims of also who have differing interpretations of the Islamic tradition are battling with one another. However, as an historian, one of the advantages you do have is having a long range view of things. And I note that 30, 40 years ago, the situation in the Middle East was in many ways far worse. We used to wake up every Tuesday and find that there was some revolution in the area, and some president was being taken out and shot, and a new dictator had come into power. It has been many, many years since there has been such a revolution in the Middle East, and there isn't today, in fact, much more openness in terms of the flow of ideas, the internet, news stations that are really unprecedented. And there was a time in the Middle East, in my lifetime, when just about every Middle Eastern state was technically or actively at war with one or at least one of its neighbors, and that's not the case anymore either. So I can see great improvements in the Middle East over the course of the last 30, 40 years. The region is not static. It's highly dynamic. And I can see in another few decades, I mean, not tomorrow, but in a few decades, a situation which would be much improved from what it is today. I mean, who would have thought 70, 80 years ago that the French and the Germans would be such good friends today? They were massacring each other by the millions. But at the risk of sounding Pollyanna-ish, I do have long-term hopes for Middle East peace.
Well, let's talk with someone in Urbana next. This is line 2. Hello.
Hello. A couple of points. The first is, I suppose, minor. But your pirates in North Africa were actually privateers. They were operating under letters from the Ottoman Empire, and it was part of an ongoing and long-going war in the Mediterranean between the Ottoman Empire and the French, primarily French and Spanish. So my point would be the things there are much more murky than they might appear. The other has to do with the Russian favoring of a return of Jews to the Holy Land. And this, I think, had much less to do with Russian Zionism than it had to do with a long-standing attempt by the Russians to insert themselves into the Middle East and essentially destroy the Ottoman Empire so that they could become the Middle Eastern power. And it was opposed, of course, by the British for that very reason. Again, things are somewhat more murky than they might appear. I would point out that in 1900, the Jewish population of Palestine was about 7%, which I think was not very well understood even in England or the United States. Jews had lived there with their Arab neighbors for about 1,400 years and had more rights than modern Arabs have under Jewish domination. I shouldn't say Jewish. I should say Zionist domination. I think there's actually a better chance of these people coming to an accommodation. They've had that for centuries, and I think if Zionism were taken out of the equation, that a Jewish state could very well become part of the Middle East. and that they could mutually profit. But it would have to be that both sides would be willing to take the religious element out of the political, which actually the Arabs managed to do pretty well for most of the period they were in power.
Well, let's get some.
Is this a question for me about America and the Middle East? I'm not sure. We have a great number of political statements here, which are not really questions, and I'm having trouble trying to framing them as questions. I'm not certain what Russia's involvement in the Middle East in 1900 has to do with America and the Middle East. I don't think Russians, to the degree that Russia was interested in Zionism at all, it stemmed from anti-Semitism. They wanted simply, the Russian leadership wanted to get rid of its Jews as quickly as possible and didn't really care where they went as long as they weren't in Russia. As for the Barbary pirates operating under letters of empowerment from their states, that may have been true during the medieval period or even the Renaissance period. By the time of the late 18th century, these were state-sponsored pirates. They were not operating against the French. They were not operating against the English. They were operating principally against the small states of Europe who were paying them off and against the Americans, and religion played a role in it. Thomas Jefferson, in March 1785, wrote an astonishing report of a meeting that he conducted with the representative of Libya, what was then called Tripoli, a gentleman by the name of Abdulrahman al-Najjar. Jefferson had said to al-Najjar, the American people bear no animosity toward the people of your kingdom, of the people of the Middle East. All we want to do is trade freely in the area, free of harm. And Abdulrahman turned to him and said, no, we have to make war against you because you're one of the infidel states, and our holy book says that we must enslave all infidels. We must carry on this holy war, and if we fall in the course of this holy war, we will alight immediately to paradise. Now, that sounds vaguely familiar to us, I would imagine, today, but to Thomas Jefferson, it was absolutely appalling, and he reported this conversation verbatim to the Continental Congress, and he concluded that this is essentially not just a matter of privateering and piracy, it's a matter of holy war, and the United States would not be able to reach an accommodation with this kingdom and other kingdoms of the Barbary Coast. So, going back to then, it was very much a state-sponsored, what would be called today a jihadist theology involved in it. And we have Thomas Jefferson as our witness on that. As for the many remarks about Zionism, that Jews back in 1900 had greater rights than Arabs living under Israel today, they had no right of speech, they had no right of vote, they had no right of assembly. Arabs in Israel today have all of those rights, certainly, and there is now an Arab member, an Arab Muslim member of the Israeli cabinet. There was certainly no Jewish member of the Palestinian governments in 1900. It's kind of, forgive me, I mean to sound disrespectful, but the comparison is kind of laughable. As for Zionism, since so many people seem to bring up Zionism, an unfavorable point, Zionism is the national liberation movement of the Jewish people. That's what it means. It means the Jewish people have a right to a state in their holy land. That state has become a focus of controversy. It says nothing about the nature of Zionism or the right of the Jews to have a homeland, to have their self-determination, as much as the Palestinians have a right and other peoples of the Middle East have that right. To deny Jews that right is unfair. I think it's illicit. Had the Jews had that right prior to 1940, 6 million of them would be alive, and their descendants would be alive today.
We're almost out of time. The last item in the title, fantasy, I'm just hoping that you could talk for a minute or so about people's, again, going back some time, people's ideas of the Middle East. I was very struck by your mention in the book that in early America, certainly one of the most read books would be the Bible. But other than that, a very well-read and a book that a lot of people would have had, what actually was a translation of The Thousand and One Nights, the collection of folk tales. How did people's idea of the Middle East, and maybe it was not a true one, affect their interest in engaging with it or the way they engaged with it?
Well, keep in mind, in early America, Americans had really no direct or reliable information about the Middle East. What they did have was this book, 1001 Nights, which is the second most popular book on the colonial bookshelf after the Bible. And you know the stories of 1001 Nights, Sinbad the Sailor, Scheherazade, Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves. It's a highly romanticized, highly eroticized image of the Middle East. Americans read this book and believed that this is what the Middle East looked like. And starting with John Ledyard, a close friend of Thomas Jefferson's, who traveled to the Middle East in the 1780s, they began to leave the United States in increasingly large numbers. By the 1860s, Americans had surpassed the English as the largest single group of tourists in the Middle East. You see the Englishmen complaining about how the Americans have snatched up all the good hotel rooms in Damascus. And they come to the Middle East, and they are very disconcerted to see that it bears really no resemblance to what they've read in A Thousand and One Nights. We read about the disappointment in the journals of Mark Twain, later published as Innocents Abroad, or the diary of Herman Melville, who came to the Middle East in the 1850s. Again, this great disappointment. And yet the American myths, the myths of the Middle East that were harbored in the American imagination are so deep-seated that all of these reports back by Americans coming back from the Middle East that really don't change them at all. And you see Middle Eastern fantasies really being the great attraction at the Chicago World's Fair in 1893. You see Hollywood appropriating them for its first blockbuster films like The Sheikh of Araby. Hollywood is still making Middle Eastern fantasy movies. But fantasy also had an impact on policy. Fantasy, the notion that, for example, one of the fantasies that John Ledyard in the 1780s developed was that the peoples of the Middle East are basically liberty-loving. They're like the frontiersman who's out in the wilderness on his horse, and it's only the presence of these tyrannical governments and despotisms that deny the Middle Easterners this freedom. And if Americans will just come along and remove those tyrannies, then people of the Middle East will embrace their natural love of freedom. And to understand that myth is to understand, in part, America's involvement in Iraq today.
Yeah, well, there we'll have to leave it. If you'd like to read the book, it is Power, Faith, and Fantasy, America in the Middle East, 1776 to the Present, by our guest Michael Oren. It's published by W.W. Norton. Michael Oren spending some time here in the United States talking about the book. He's in Chicago today, and will be speaking at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. So for more information, you can consult their website. Mr. Oren, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Have a good day, David.